This podcast is brought to you by DIA, the trusted global neutral forum for healthcare product development professionals. DIA, driving insights to action.
In late March 2017, DIA organized its first ever BioVenture Day in Glasgow, a new platform designed to connect stakeholders critical to the success of BioVentures and designed to investigate if the current BioVenture paradigm delivers equitable return for patients, investors, and healthcare systems in Europe. The stakeholders included Dr. Luca Pani, who served as Director General of the Italian Medicines Agency from 2011 to 2016, and is currently a member of the European Medicines Agency's Committee for Medicinal Products for Human Use, the CHMP, and its Scientific Advice Working Party. I am Alberto Grignolo, editor of DIA's Global Forum. Today, I am speaking with Dr. Pani to discuss innovation in the EU's healthcare systems. Thank you for your time today, Dr. Pani, and welcome.
Thank you for having me.
The presentation you delivered at this event in Glasgow asked an important question in its very title, and I quote, "Health system financing and reimbursement of innovation. Is parallel micro-innovation overburdening the healthcare system?" Unquote. What did you mean, and what is your answer?
First of all, let me say there's a pleasure and honor to be here with your listeners and to DIA. And of course, everything I say is personal and cannot reflect the agencies for which I've worked or which I'm associated. We wanted to set forth a provocative title. And you just read it. So the concept is this: innovation for the structure of the medical technology has been known with the work of Bloom about 25 years ago, separated in four phases: the exploratory phase, the development phase, the diffusion, evaluation and assessment, and finally the feedback from the use from the customers. And this is what we all difficulties are trying to define in terms of the innovation. But in the meantime, micro-innovation, which means basically working on existing product and make them better in a sense, uses a kind of premium prices. So these two things in parallel seem to run together, but they become very difficult, if you think about, for the total sustainability of the system. On one side, you have innovative, true breakthrough type of product. On the other side, you have, I want to put it a little bit provocative again, old products that are refurbished by micro-innovation. These two things cannot be named and especially reimbursed as innovation, both of them. Don't you agree?
Is parallel micro-innovation a fancy term for me-too drugs or incremental improvement in drugs?
Yeah, this is an important question. It's a little bit more than that. It is a me-too, but it's also something that really goes within the desires and the need of the customers. Being customers, I use a very broad term, from hospital managements to healthcare providers, of course, to patients, to everybody in the network of the health system. During the talk, we gave an example that we took from the literature of what happened of micro-innovation in another field, and was the detergent market. The detergent market, the market that you use to, you know, to do your laundry, basically. Okay, the story goes like this: the Fox, Procter and Gamble were fighting very hard to gain a share of the 7 billion detergent market. They try everything, very peculiar type of detergent, which is a very volatile market, very difficult to stay in. Instead of inventing some revolutionary cleaning, innovative type of serum or detergent, what they use was the small packaging, those we call pods. Everybody knows them, right? So those things immediately got an incredible stunning success and made $500 million of revenues in the first year. That's a typical example of a micro innovation. You might say, this is a me too, right? Actually, it's not even a me too. They took Tide, the commercial name was Tide,
right,
the detergent, and they did not do anything except repackaging Tide in that particular thing. But think about it. They made something really micro-innovative because they interject also practicality, usage, the customer, not wasting your detergent, and environmental sensitive consciousness that was growing up in the customers. So to have a success like this with this amount of marketing share means you have not just done a me too. You've done something else. And that's right. What we call micro-innovation.
In another way, are you saying that the healthcare systems of today can only accommodate breakthrough therapies and not micro-innovation or marginal improvements in existing therapies?
It can. What I'm saying is that it can accommodate both and even much more than this, providing that then we decide what are the parameters for reimbursement and sustainability. And that's another part of the talk in which we say, basically, that what we have to, now we are all concentrated on innovation, the or micro or macro. But the example, another example that we delivered at the talk was the example of the sofosbuvir saga. So that you have an innovative drug, no doubt. Fast innovative drug, because it was only 25 years between the moment in which the hepatitis C virus was discovered and this drug came. They basically eradicated the virus. So an incredible success by all means, first of all, scientific. And you have a drug that has, for sure, is delivering what was promised to do. So you have clearly an outcome measure that works. And then what happens? At the end of the day, the drug became almost unsustainable in almost all markets, all areas. So again, it's not a problem of innovation per se, but of the delivery and sustainability of this innovation. I wrote a book last year, it's called Sustainable Innovation. There is on Amazon, it's for free, everybody can download it. There is a couple of chapters in which you can see where we think real innovation is going. First of all, the definition of innovation, that will help. And then linking innovation to a system of reimbursability that, for instance, shows and certifies avoided costs. That would be very, very helpful. If you in the Tide example, you can show and you waste less detergent, you wash better, and you are less polluting the environment, there are for sure avoided costs that actually justify the success of, and even the expenditure, even the premium price that you can get to the small packaging. So this clearly to change a little bit our attitude, I would say.
What is going to make innovation sustainable? Is it concepts like paying for results, which I believe the Italian agents pioneered over time and other agencies and companies are undertaking? Is that the answer, to pay for results and to not pay when drugs do not deliver the expected results?
That is the starting point. And I think now several companies are agreeing very much on this. When we started the management entry agreements criteria, not only us, but also other countries, mainly in Europe, but also in other parts of the world. The idea was between cost sharing, risk sharing, and mainly payment by results. Now that we have payment by results that can be linked to biomarkers, to measures that are, in a sense, certifiable, and that's another passage I think is essential, to real-life data, real-world evidence through registries, something else we have developed very much in the last five years in the Italian agency, which is also a reimbursement agency, I have to remind our listeners. This, I think, can work. If I can show and certify that the number of liver transplant or the number of stroke or cardiovascular accident after lowering cholesterol drugs are saving me money to the system, then I can reinvest. And that is the innovation will be, the premium price of innovation will be justified. So I think my position personally is to go toward the direction involving as many stakeholders as you may get together. And that's why the DIA was a very good venue in doing this, because you would have patient representatives, you have healthcare providers, of course, industry payers, regulators. That was very good to have this kind of approach, because we have to agree, in a sense, on what is our menu to get innovation sustainable. Otherwise, you will be with surprises like the one of the lowering cholesterol drugs, monoclonal antibody, but also many other situations like the one of the hepatitis C. But also, I'm going long in this answer, but I think it's important, with the combination therapy for the immuno checkpoint for the metastatic melanoma. Now, the long survival, the long survivors were not in the picture for this disorder. So, and we are very happy that now they are in the picture. Absolutely happy for the patients, for the families. This is a miracle. There are patients alive 7, 8, 9 years, but we did not have the pharmacoeconomical model to sustain that. Nobody had it. my suspect is not even the drug company that developed these drugs had this pharmacological model. It's a very nice problem to have, but yet we have it. And my suspicion is we're going to have more and more of this. So either we interlink databases and we try to pose the right questions to the databases in order to convert the data and information and information into knowledge, or we'll be doing phishing expedition, and that is not going to work.
Let me ask you, how would you describe the regulator's current role in healthcare innovation? Specifically, the Italian agency has been a pioneer in combining, if you will, under one roof, as you well know, regulation and reimbursement of medicines. There are other agencies, for example, the US FDA, that keep quite a distance from anything having to do with reimbursement, much less pricing. Is there a benefit in your experience in combining both functions, regulatory and reimbursement, in the same agency? Is that an appropriate role for a regulatory agency today and in the future?
I am completely biased on this, so I confess my full conflict of interest, and my answer is yes. I even think that should be done in the same commission. So the commission should be a scientific economical commission, because the concept of sustainability in the duration of the response, final efficacy, superiority trial, everything will come into the picture. What is the good of a drug that is absolutely life-saving that cannot be sustained? Zero. And when they finally arrive with something like this, we say, oh, but it costs too much. We ask them to cut the prices. How is this working, guys?
Something's wrong with this picture.
Something's wrong with the picture. Something is wrong with the total system. I don't know if something that I read is true, but I was told that in the US, I think for a $6 billion expenditure for the anti-Hep C, less than 5% of the totally eligible population was treated. And in Italy also, we had to restrict the access because of the price. In this case, of course, this becomes the problem. As price goes into, in a sense, the final access to the drug, we have to take this into account, because this will change the number of patients that we treat. It's an evaluation of risk-benefit in terms, for instance, of health policy, public health policy. Think about it. You want to eradicate Hep C, you need to have this drug available. Otherwise, you would not eradicate. So it's a typical scientific question affected by the price.
Right. I would argue that the role of the regulator is to look at quality, safety, and efficacy, and that reimbursement and similar decisions belong in another venue. You seem to have the opposite view, namely that having both under one roof is the best way to handle innovation and the availability of innovation to patients.
Yeah, especially, yeah, absolutely. Especially by linking this to real world data, so that I know if a drug that is promised to deliver certain things, so I'm still at the scientific FDA side, okay, not payers, is really delivering it. So that the positioning of the drug for the reimbursement system changes whether or not it delivers 99% of what it said or 69% of what it said. That will require scientific reappraisal. So this will enter into the price form. But again, when you ask me what is the position of the UL regulators, I don't think it's this one I'm saying. I'm a little divergent.
So let's think ahead, looking at the horizon. How will the role of the regulator evolve? We're clearly in the middle of a sea change in attitudes in relation to patient access of medicines, particularly innovative medicines that might come at a price perceived to be, quote, high, unquote. So how will the regulator's role change, for example, in Europe in the next 5, 10, 20 years?
If they don't take into account the changes that are happening in the basically IT space, the apps and other players, I name names, I mean, Google, Apple, IBM, Microsoft. If they don't take into account this, the real data and the sensors technology will generate a vast amount of data also in the usage of medicine. And that will make basically regulation per se like an online continuous experience, continuous user experience. That's what they're called. If you don't take into any account of this and you still want to play by the old rules, I'm afraid that this time the wave will hit you as a regulator. So we will require to change our style of doing business, because the business is changing everywhere.
Will the standards of regulators change, or will the way they do business and operate every day change?
No, I think the standards will not change. safety and, of course, efficacy and all the evaluation that should be first and foremost, even more reinforced, but with new means and with different tools. And that will change the way we do business.
Tools having to do with real-world data, real-world evidence, the ability to use such evidence to make decisions, maybe artificial intelligence as well, do you think?
Absolutely correct, yes. All of the above. And artificial intelligence, especially with the deep learning type of connectomes that put together several data. You know, if you have multiple sclerosis and a sensor tells me that you're able to go to the bathroom, your house, and the sensor perimeter in the house tells me that you're doing your chores autonomously, I know more. And in your case, it's personalized, it's specific, and it's participatory because you have to allow me to access your data with all the privacy and security perimeter. That will show if the drug is really delivering what it was supposed to do. And that, therefore, is not only efficacy, but it's also worth reimbursement. You see, in my mind, it's two things that are completely connected. Now, if you ask me, are you saying that you will, in a sense, put your efficacy and safety evaluation below the price? No, I would not do that. I would not think price should drive the way we do risk-benefit. We still do risk-benefit first, and then price is a matter of negotiation. But if you also ask, would price be completely separated in another venue, in another commission, in another agency, in another system? I think those times are over.
It seems that you feel that if regulators ignore the pricing and reimbursement side of things in relation to innovation, they're simply putting their heads in the sand and not recognizing the realities that are upon us. Would that be a fair way to put it, or did I miss?
No, very fair. They will put the head in the sand, and then somebody will come below them in the sand and will say, guess what? This is what's happening while you were hiding. So the payers should be involved very early in the course of whatever HTA, scientific advice, combined type of evaluation we do. And the payers should ask the companies way in advance what type of evidence they want in order to reimburse on a certain range. And I know this as caveats, of course, because if you then sign a contract 3 years or 5 years in advance saying, oh, if you deliver this, I will recognize a premium price of that, and then something else happens, you don't have the room for negotiation. That's very awkward for them. So we need to build, as I said, together, sort of new negotiation strategies and contractual agreements to take into account all these things. And I think it can be done. But the war like business as usual, I know we never done something like this. So I don't think it's going to hold anymore.
A final question, Brexit. Brexit is obviously a topic of growing importance to everybody in Europe and particularly to the European healthcare community. From your perspective, should patients worry about Brexit? What steps can regulators take to alleviate this concern?
The most important thing that worries me is not whether or not the European Medicine Agency will move or where we move or what countries, but really what we'll do about the incredible contribution that English colleagues have given in general to the regulatory world and in particular to the European Medicine Agency's dossier. If I'm not mistaken, about 25% of the total procedures, different levels, okay, from inspections to pharmacovigilance and scientific advices, and of course, reportership and co-reportership for the CHMP are handled by MHRA. And then don't forget the important rule of NICE. NICE has developed incredible tools to evaluate drugs, to do HTA, pave the way. So what I'm more worried about and what I think the European should be more worried about is what will happen of all this knowledge when is, if I understand correctly, I'm not very good politically, when it's placed outside the European network.
Would you therefore advocate negotiators should find a way for the MHRA and NICE to continue being involved in European drug regulation and reimbursement frameworks for the sake of patients throughout Europe?
If this, my understanding is this apparently is very difficult for the nature of the Article 50. But again, I'm not no expert in this, so I don't know if they can play a role like Norway does, I mean, now in our network. Of course, the size of Norway and the size of the UK is very difficult, but it's very different. But yeah, something like that. I wish we, in general, that's my general attitude, I wish we do not despair and lose experience. Because, you know, history is that, as is used to say, is so bad. If you don't know your mistakes, then you make them again and again and again. UK contribution has been very, very strong, fundamental to the network in the last 20 years.
Well, we'll stop it right there. And obviously, the situation will be followed by all of us for years to come. Thank you very much for your time today, Dr. Pani. It was a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you very much.
For DIA Global Forum, I am Alberto Grignolo.
To learn more about this topic, visit us online at diaglobal.org.